This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On today's program, we'll have in studio Shanera Lampkins, the general manager of the Gary Public Transportation Corporation, and RDA spokesman Dave Wellman to talk about this week's Regional Transportation Summit. It'll get underway tomorrow and will be held at the Indiana Tourism Center in Hammond. Some crucial conversations dealing with the connectivity of the transportation system for the region. We'll also have for you as well another edition of Green Fleet Radio with Carl Lissick, and we'll hear from Keith Kirkpatrick with another Lakeshore-focused conversation. Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. We're continuing discussion about the issue of transportation here in Northwest Indiana, and the discussion is going to be expanded here this week with the creation of a Regional Transportation Summit. It is a program that gets underway here on Thursday and continuing on Friday morning at the Indiana Welcome Center in Hammond. And with us to talk about it, we have two guests in studio. We have Daryl Lampkins, who's the general manager of the Gary Public Transportation Corporation. Daryl, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
You're welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. And also with us in studio is a spokesrepresentative for the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority, Dave Wellman. Dave, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Chris.
Well, first, I guess, let's talk in about the issue of public transportation in particular. Transportation is kind of a broad topic, and that incorporates, of course, vehicular traffic, but we're focusing mainly here on finding better ways to move people around by public transportation. And we know that it's historically been a really, really big problem. And Daryl, I know that you have spent a lot of time dealing with it from your standpoint there with the GPTC. Give us a brief history lesson, if you will, about how public transportation has worked or not worked here in Northwest Indiana.
Well, I wouldn't say that it hasn't worked. I'd say
maybe it can
that
work better. Than
it can
it, it
can
had,
work
yeah.
better. Mm-hmm. I think that what we are lacking here in Northwest Indiana is what most transit agencies today are facing, and that's resources. Mm-hmm. The larger communities that you're in, they have access to larger resources, but what they also have is traffic congestion, and traffic congestion tends to lead to push people more to transit when you have an option one way or the other. We don't have a lot of traffic congestion in Northwest Indiana, but that doesn't minimize the need for choice and needed dependent riders. I came in about 12 years ago, Gary Public Transportation, and we have not grown very much. We like to call it that we've remained steady. And what we're attempting to do with this conference is just start the conversation in terms of how do we expand transit in all modes. The Westlake Quarter is one thing that's on the radar. I think that bus dovetails well into that. Mm-hmm. You need bus if you're going to expand rail for connectivity, but you also have airport traffic and bike traffic, and we want to just start the conversation. How do we tie all of those things together?
I know that the GPTC has been really working hard to try to take over in a way, because we at one point had several public transportation systems that were working at the same time here in particular in Lake County, and then down to basically only one. It ended up being down to Gary's, and I know that meant a lot of work for you folks to be able to take on routes that were out there in other communities. Tell us what you all faced here when you found that the number of players, the number of public transit companies in the region suddenly came down to one.
Well, I hesitate to use the word take over. We prefer to use the term that we filled a void. Mm-hmm. And where transit went away. And it was the situation, again, it was regarding funding. The agencies that couldn't are no longer with us ran out of funds. There are a few other agencies that do exist that provide some paratransit transportation. We are the only fixed route provider. Well, I take that back. East Chicago has a system also. So there's two fixed route services that are remaining in Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm.
That might be something important to talk about is to how the funding is set up so that, in particular, that GPTC is able to operate here. And because that's the same kind of funding that these other agencies had trouble obtaining, it's something to talk about because we're talking, what, state and federal as well as local, aren't we?
Absolutely. We do receive funding from the federal government. We receive funding from the state government. And our local funding is primarily due through property taxes and fare box and any other type of fundings that we can find, multiple sources. Advertising, for instance, is one that we do when we – you see maybe some of the buses wrapped and things like that. So the challenge that we have with the funding is on the local end primarily. Mm-hmm. In terms of securing an increase or stable funding to match the federal dollars that we use.
Dick Wellman, who is here with the Northwest Indiana RDA, is one of the partners in trying to see some improvement in all of this. And we know that RDA plays a very big role in all of this. What does first does the RDA have to do when it comes to public transportation?
Well, currently the primary project that we're backing is the recapitalization of the South Shore line,
right,
which includes the Westlake corridor and as well as double tracking the existing South Shore line. We have spent the last roughly 3 years putting together a package of local and state support in terms of funding to get to about half the cost of that of doing those two projects, and are now in the process of applying to the federal government for grants to cover the other 50% of the cost. So again, we're in a similar boat as Daryl is, in that resources are the primary limiting factor at the moment, and we're working as hard as we can to overcome that.
Now, obviously, in the case of the RDA, you're working very closely with all of the communities here in the region, including the community of Gary. And I know in your case, Daryl, that you have to basically go to the Common Council and to Mayor Freeman Wilson and ask for help if you need it in particular, even though that you are able to pick up other communities as far as your service area is concerned. Do you find that this is a sort of a common problem, that in this case here, the RDA is working to look for has the partnership, I guess, from the communities, of course, for a commitment to be able to show some support for, in this case, for the expansion on the South Shore line, as well as you're looking for assistance as well, I suppose, maybe more beyond local, for expanding the public transit per service?
Absolutely. We've partnered with the RDA over the years, and they've been supportive of some service that we had for the Lakeshore Connection and the old Tri-City route. We understand as an agency also that not just the RDA, but some of the other municipalities, that we're all competing for a limited amount of funds. And what we're attempting to do at this summit is to not only display, but to also convince and to bring in some stakeholders and discuss some of the challenges and how we can move towards future growth in the region, talk about efficiencies and effectiveness. One thing that we have done at Gary Public Transportation over the last 12 years or so is we've just improved our operation to the point where right now we just can't go any further without other communities and agencies buying in.
Right.
And that's what we're looking to to have that start that conversation.
I imagine that probably when it came to the point that the Gary Public Transportation Corporation was able to step into Hammond as well as into Highland and other communities where the Lakeshore service had been running with the old service that was there before, you had to do some shuffling around to be able to still continue to do the routes in Gary that you were already servicing. And now you're expanding south of there. You're into Maryville, basically, and points even closer to Crown Point now with the work that's expanding on the Broadway Express line.
Absolutely. We're doing the best that we can to provide the service where we think that the service is needed. The one thing that when we have our board meetings and people come and ask us about providing more service, we ask them that they take an active role in trying to convince the not only the local but the state legislators also in terms of supporting transit in a manner that will allow us to grow.
Now, Dave, I know that much of this transportation summit that is coming up this week is basically Daryl's responsibility with the GPTC, but I know that you folks at the RDA are working very closely, I'm sure, with him on this program, because you have a lot to deal with, not only getting the information, but you'd probably like to learn something as well, that maybe some more innovative ways to deal with things that, in turn, you could put to work for your other projects.
Certainly. I mean, we're always looking both at this event as well as on our own at different ways to do the projects that we're working on right now, and innovative financing methods, beyond simply asking for grants from various state and federal agencies. And so anything along those lines would be certainly very helpful and something we'd be very interested in. As far as this conference is concerned, it's simply a great opportunity for us to get the message of connectivity out there. It's not something I think a lot of people think about in terms of an infrastructure question, because transportation is a piece of infrastructure, just like a road or a fiber optic cable or a power line, that is necessary. It's a necessary prerequisite for jobs, for economic development, and I want to make sure that that message gets out there and people understand that it's more than the traditional idea of transportation, but we're making an investment in our communities that's going to pay back dividends over the long term.
Mm-hmm. Is that a difficult message to get out?
I don't think people think of it in those terms yet. It's a challenge. I think it's still thought of more along the lines of just transportation, of just something for certain segments or for certain places, that you don't need it here or there. And it's something that people ask questions like, well, I don't ride on it. Why should I pay for it? Well, you don't ride on every road. You don't use every power line. Again, these are things that you need that throw off benefits to the entire community. They allow people to find jobs, to get to work, and they take that money that they make at work and they spend it in the stores and in the region, and that benefits everyone.
And I imagine, Daryl, that's probably the link that you use with your service every day, because you have such a diverse ridership in almost every, maybe not every, but almost every income level. And almost every member of the community, whether it's African American or Hispanic, or Caucasian, it doesn't matter. There are a number of people, and a lot of people do have to use the bus as a major way to get around, not only to work but to get shopping done and other tasks that they like to do. So you probably like to see some way to be able to link all this together.
Absolutely, and again, that's the impetus behind this conference and the summit. A good example is over the last couple of years, Gary Public Transportation, East Chicago, North Township, and Everybody Counts, an organization, and North Methodist, we meet monthly and just kind of brainstorm and talk about things that we can do to improve transit operations for not only the fixed route service, but for our disability community also. And what we call it, that agency, is the South Shore Transit Alliance. I think it's a good example of how people can get in the same room and have differences. And at the end of that meeting, you can then talk about how you can solve those problems. But if you don't communicate and you don't talk and share that information, it's very difficult to get there.
We have Daryl Lampkins with the Gary Public Transportation Corporation in studio, along with Dave Wellman, who is a representative of the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority. And we're talking in here in particular about the very special Regional Transportation Summit that is coming up. It's going to be held on Thursday, tomorrow, and part of the day on Friday. It's going to happen at the Indiana Welcome Center, which is, of course, just off 8094. It's actually off Kennedy Avenue, literally, but it's in the intersection of Kennedy Avenue and 8094 in Hammond. Daryl, if you will, time to take us through the program and the agenda, who all is going to be involved, and what you're going to try and cover in this day and a half.
Sure. The beginning of the summit starts at 7:30 a.m. It's a little early, but that's registration, 7:30 to 9, and there'll be a continental breakfast. At 9 o'clock, we'll kick the summit off. I'll open it up and talk a little bit about what the summit is going to be about in terms of outreach, in terms of how we can improve the challenges that we're facing, and future growth. We're going to have some state legislators that'll be there, that'll be talking about how it the state can assist, or what do they see as our role in the region and their role. And we'll have some individuals from the federal government that'll be there talking about how they support transit. And during the course of the day, we'll also have a bus tour. It starts at, well, prior to the bus tour, there's a lunch, I'm sorry, and then we'll have a panel discussion.
Yeah, that's going to be an important thing. You're going to get more people together that if they aren't already stakeholders, you want to be sure that everybody's in
and
there.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't add that our guest speaker, is a gentleman by the name of Miguel Southwell. Mm-hmm. And he used to run the airport in Atlanta, so you can imagine he has a lot of experience in transit. Then we'll go to the panel. The panel will consist of a number of individuals from different parts of the community, and we'll talk about connectivity, we'll talk about future growth, we'll talk about challenges, we'll even talk, I think that bikes even play a role in transit as today, in today's society. So moving from there, we'll have a tour. I think it starts at about 1 or 1:30. And that tour, the purpose of that tour is to visit some of the areas that have potential in terms of connectivity and show how transportation can help reach that that goal in terms of economic development and connectivity, whether it's business, social, or medical. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the tour, we go over to the airport and have from 5 to 7, we're going to have a session and a reception and a networking and get to know people, and there's going to be a presentation there also.
Well, it sounds like Thursday's going to be a very, very, very busy day, to say the least. Now, what's going to happen in for the morning session on Friday?
Well, Friday we come back at 9 a.m., and we open up the session for Friday. I'll introduce Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson of Gary, and she will give her opinion and view on how transit is important for not only Gary but for the region. And then it closes, it shuts down at 1 p.m., but I think I missed one. The federal government, the regional administrator, acting regional administrator for the federal FTA, will be giving a presentation.
Oh, that's right. Kelly Brookins, I think. Brookins. She's coming in part of the presentation on Friday. From Region 5.
Yeah. And she'll give FTA. Give her overview in terms of the role of the FTA.
And I see, too, Dave, that the RDA has a role to play as well in the discussion on Friday, that representative is going to be part of the panel discussion after we hear the officials make their comments.
Yep. Absolutely. We're going to be there to talk, again, about connectivity, about what it means for the region, and about how we can work better together to make it happen.
Well, now it sounds like you have a very full program for the day and a half, and I imagine that probably most everybody who has expressed interest in attending the summit starting in and on Thursday has probably said, yeah, I'm going to be there. You have to count heads to be able to have enough lunches and snacks and everything together, too, but is there an opportunity for folks that may be hearing us talk about it today that are interested, that can make it over to the Indiana Welcome Center Thursday and Friday?
Absolutely. We're turning no one away. The capacity, I believe, is about 125. Mm-hmm. There's no cost to attend the summit, but we would welcome residents to come by and partake and listen. And if we have an opportunity to give some input into where they see the needs are for transit in the region. Absolutely.
The original transportation summit is going to take place on Thursday, most of the day, and again on Friday. And it's hosted by the Gary Public Transportation Corporation with other stakeholders helping out as well, too. It's going to happen Thursday and Friday, the 17th and 18th. It'll be at the Indiana Welcome Center in Hammond. And we've been finding out more about the program and the issues of public transportation with Daryl Lampkins with the GPTC and Dave Wellman, who represents the Northwest Indiana RDA. And gentlemen, thank you for being with us today to talk about this. It sounds like you have a great attendance already planned, and I hope an opportunity there for folks that would like to check out the issue and have something to say about public transportation, we'll have a chance to join in as well, too, this week.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for another edition of Green Fleet Radio, and here is your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today our guest is Mr. Charles Bradsky. He's the Transportation Projects Manager for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, or NERPC. Charles, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Hey, Charles, could you remind our listeners what is NERPC and what is your job there?
NERPC is the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission, and we are a regional government that advocates for planning for what's best for the region. We consist of representatives from all the communities in all three counties of the region, Lake, Porter, and LaPorte. I am the Transportation Projects Manager, as you mentioned. That means I manage the short-term program or the transportation projects within the region that will be occurring within the next 4 to 6 years. I, along with the representatives from each community, program federal monies for these transportation projects.
So you got a big job.
There's a team. We're a team.
Yes. And again, I think, you know, a lot of people don't realize how much NERPC actually is involved in Lake, LaPorte, and Porter County. And I always like to say they're the government of the governments. I mean, I think you work with every one of the communities, every one of the counties. So it's, you know, it's just a really big organization that does a lot of great things for air quality and transportation planning. So, you know, I also understand that you're a big cycling enthusiast. So how did you get involved with that?
Well, I started, like most everybody, I started in college and just getting from class to class. And then it also helped out that I had a couple guys in my fraternity that were on the USA cycling team.
No kidding.
So they got me involved in road cycling, and I kind of got out of it after school, but then about 4 or 5 years, 6, 7 years ago, I think, I got back into it. Now I have 3 to 6 buddies that I ride with regularly, and we push each other.
Mm-hmm. Great exercise. So how is NERPC working to encourage folks to bike instead of using their vehicles?
Well, trails. Trails is a big is a big focus on many communities' portfolio of upcoming projects. Mass transit is one solution for congestion. So are all the bike trails. For instance, I bike to work at least one day a week. And I know several people that either use the trails for walking to work or biking to work. With the focus nowadays on a healthy lifestyle and everybody's wearing Fitbits, so people are doing a lot more walking and biking for recreation. So going to the store, if going to the store is only a couple blocks away, people are walking instead of jumping in the car.
Sure, sure. We're talking to Charles Bradsky. He's the Transportation Projects Manager for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. So, Charles, why don't you tell us, you know, that you talk about the trail system. So what is new with our trail systems to assist cyclists?
Well, I'm really excited about the Marquette Greenway, which a predecessor of mine, well, friend of mine, Mertz Barloga, has been championing.
Sure. Mitch is no stranger to this show.
That's a 58-mile trail that extends from Chicago to New Buffalo, Michigan. The trail will eventually link communities, major parks, and a wide variety of cultural, natural, and economic assets in Northwest Indiana. As of now, there's about 28 miles of those that are funded and are in various stages of planning or construction. And it's been reported a couple months ago that NERPC had applied for a federal grant.
Sure.
For this amazing trail. But sadly, we didn't get the grant. But we plan on applying for future grants and moving ahead, securing funding as we go along. It may take a little bit longer, but just a trail that would connect all through all these communities would be just fantastic.
That would really be fantastic. So I understand there's also a new trail map that's coming out soon. Where can our listeners get one of those?
The 2018 trail map should be coming out at the end of May.
Okay.
So it'll be available at all the same locations that it's been available for, that the 16 trail map was available, you know, bike stores, welcome centers, and as well as NERPC.
I see. And so I know the 2050 plan is something that's a big undertaking with NERPC. Why don't you give our listeners a little update on that?
Well, the 2050 plan is NERPC's long-range plan. From the planning perspective, we are trying to project what life will be like in the not-so-distant future. By envisioning what life will be like, we'll be able to make and plan and prepare for that future. We update this plan every 4 years, And NERPC had several open houses recently from last of April to the middle of May.
Mm-hmm.
We gathered input to articulate the region's visions and needs. So we're wrapping that up, and we're beginning to look at the influences and trends that may shape our future.
So if people still wanted to get involved with that, how would they go about that, Charles?
Actually, talk to your communities mm-hmm. and your community leaders and find out what they would like to see, and just kind of talk with them or talk with us and see what we're kind of envisioning.
Sure.
Like I said, we've done some open houses, so mm-hmm. we've talked to a lot of the people, as well as online. You can always email. In fact, I think the question and answer form is public input is still open up on the NERPC
Wonderful.
Website.
Okay. And so if people want to learn more about NERPC and cycling resources, where should they go for that?
Well, the NERPC website is a great resource for what's happening at NERPC. We try to be proactive with all of our programs. But as far as bicycling resources, grab your helmet and go for a ride. There's several bike shops that can answer most of your questions. And most of those people working in the bike shops are just avid cyclists as I am. So they can answer your question whether you're looking for the nearest trailhead or the next upcoming century ride.
So how would you define a cyclist in regards to a demographic? Is there a demographic for a cyclist? I know that, for me as an old person, I used to ride my bike similar to what you were talking about at college and, to high school a lot of times because the bus, I live within a mile of the school, so I had to walk or ride. But, there's all ages I see people on the trails, on the bikes, and it just seems like there's an explosion of people that are just out there making things happen, getting healthier. And so, how would you define, potentially that perfect cyclist?
Well, I don't think there's any perfect cyclist. Mm-hmm. It's just people who want to get out and get out and ride. And we try to be proactive as far as being good passengers good cyclists on the road.
Sure.
I can't really define what the perfect cyclist is. I'm a bigger guy and I still get out and ride. And so there's no perfect cyclist.
Sure. Well, we're excited about hearing more about the 2050 plan, more about the cycling. We welcome to have you back on our show. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to Charles Bradsky. He's the Transportation Projects Manager for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And the Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio three times each day, as Carl just mentioned, here on Lakeshore Public Radio. And podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are available on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And also, if you have the NPR One app, you can get them there too. Just search for WLPR. Lakeshore Public Radio's newest furry friend, Ollie, is joining us in the studio to answer your pet's questions in our new segment, which is called Ask Ollie. It's supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, I need your advice. I'm a very handsome brown and beige full-bred Chihuahua dog, and I'm worried I'll be caught by our local animal control and deported directly to Chihuahua, Mexico, wherever that is in the universe. I can't swim the Rio Grande or jump any wall that Mexico might pay to have built, but I could dig under it to escape my fate. Even though I think I was born here and have my very own microchip, I'm concerned because I was rescued from the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana in Miller, and I find myself a little dog with no papers. Dog haters will see that I look like all the other 5-pound chihuahuas from the dog shelters and see no difference even with my chip. I don't bark with an accent, and I don't have a record with animal control. I don't even understand the Spanish language. But I'm afraid. I wish I were a hunting dog. I bet all the golden retrievers and boxers aren't worried about deportation. Maybe if I had been enrolled in dog training classes at Canine Connect in Valparaiso, I would have some papers at least. I'm not even a service dog with a cute red vest. I'm just a bed warmer, not a very big one at that. My pet mom carries me around in a big handbag or cat carrier tote, whatever. I'm thinking I can hide there, or in a pillowcase, or even a bottom drawer. Maybe no one can find me there. Buster Brown, East Chicago, Indiana.
Dear Buster, you seem to be growling a lot in misery, and I get it. It's a challenge not knowing your status as either a Native American-born dog or one brought here as a pup, or what's even harder, what Americans are currently thinking about this. Immigration discrimination is cyclical. At the turn of the century, the Irish, St. Patrick's Day festivities, and shamrocks weren't welcome in America, and that included the Irish setter dog as well. Then we had World War II, and everything German fell out of popularity, including the shepherd dogs. After the Pearl Harbor attack, the poor little Japanese chin dog and every product made in Japan was out. I remember hearing that in 2003, some Americans were so angry with French politics, they wanted to rename our delicious French fries into Freedom Fries. So I understand the roots of your paranoia. But there's always hope that this whole Mexican wall thing will pass too. In fact, the American Kennel Club just released their list of most popular dog breeds for 2017. And guess what? The German Shepherd and the French Bulldog are in the top five. Go figure. In my heart of hearts, I believe you are many tweets away from grabbing the attention of the White House. After all, you are a Chihuahua, just like the saucy little hot tamale associated with a certain fast food Mexican restaurant. That little fellow is renowned for being the world's tiniest dog with the world's biggest personality. And you said you don't have a record. You're law-abiding. You've made a great contribution to the American economy and culture. And I read somewhere that you really don't like strangers too much and you make a good watchdog. Boy, that's hard to believe. So don't quit your day job at the fast food restaurant to become a watchdog. I can tell by your writing you're a fast learner and very intelligent, which is why I said stick with the fast food gig. There's money there. While at the same time, stay close to your pet mom by hiding in that roomy tote bag. This too will pass. Sure, you may be accused of scheming with this plan, but remember, the conversation about deportation has been by two-legged folk about two-legged folk. Buster, you're a schemer with four legs and not a dreamer with only two. I think you're safe. When talking immigration policies, let's hope that four-legged schemers are never on anybody's radar. Your friend in fur, Ollie.
And if you have a question for your friend in fur, Ollie, you can email that question to Ollie, O-L-L-I-E, at lakeshorepublicmedia, all one big long word, .org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana, and Ollie's responses are voiced by his human, Victoria Voller. This is Regionally Speaking. On Lakeshore Focus, host Keith Kirkpatrick talked recently with Dawn Michaels and Dan Klein about the changing of the guard, so to speak, at Habitat for Humanity in Lake County. And here's the conversation.
Habitat for Humanity does great work in our region and everywhere. Its success is driven by incredible volunteers and excellent leadership. When that leadership changes, the past meets the future. Where we have come from and where we are going are the focus for our guest on today's show. Let's meet the past, Dan Klein, who is the previous executive director with Habitat for Humanity of Northwest Indiana, and the future in Dawn Michaels, the current executive director for the same organization. So we got the past, the present, and the future.
Is that We're all here. We're all here.
Maybe you're both kind of the present. Because you're both here, right?
We are both present. That is correct.
So this is kind of, we got to make sure that people know that you both are professionals and this is not like a comedy show, the Dan and Dawn show, right?
Well, that's correct.
It could be.
It could be.
I might need another line.
Wouldn't sell a lot of tickets, though.
So, Dan, you were in this position like how long?
I was in my 10th year.
10th year. And you came on board?
2.5 years ago. Dan hired me as the development director. Yes.
And then you stepped into that role then fairly recently then, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So, well, I want to tell you how far I go back with it because I dug through my actually dirty clothes and brought my T-shirt from, I'll let our viewers see, the 50,001st build, which was done in Gary, Indiana. So this was a pretty, how long ago was this? Maybe you guys should see the shirt.
Oh, a long time ago. How old are you?
How old am I? 2003, so this is not that long ago. But I'm sorry that the shirt looks a little dirty, but it tells you that I still continue to try to do things with my shirt.
My wife asked me to throw all my old ones out.
Oh, well, that doesn't happen in our house, obviously. I think that's a relic, you know. Can I put that in the archives after I decide I don't want to wear it anymore?
Send it to Atlanta. They can do something with it.
They probably already got one. But that's pretty incredible that the 50,001st house was built here in Northwest Indiana. So where are we at in the U.S. roughly now? How many we at?
We're well over 100,000 homes in the U.S.
So, and this organization was founded when?
1976 was when our Northwest Indiana affiliate was chartered, which was shortly after Habitat International started.
So if you really think back, it's been around 70 to 2003, so in 23 years it did 50,000, and they've over doubled that in a half that time again. So you guys are moving right along.
We are. Our affiliate, among 62 others in Indiana, are in the top 10 builders in Habitat in the U.S. So Indiana is one of the top 10 Habitat builders out of all the United States affiliates.
We should be proud of that.
It's excellent.
Yes, absolutely.
How many volunteers, I mean, just roughly in Northwest, in Lake County, I think you guys primarily focus on Lake County, right?
Correct.
So about how many volunteers are engaged in this? Is there a number you use, Dawn? Is that, you could even make one up, I don't care.
Well, I think that based upon, I don't think volunteers would be a good number. I think volunteer hours is a better number. Volunteer hours entails the restores along with the construction builds. And I know last month we had, I believe it was 800 hours alone in 1 month.
Okay.
Which is significant.
And that's a winter month, too. And we always pick up, of course, a lot with our build season in the spring and summer.
And a house takes a lot more.
It does.
Right? I mean, it seemed like when we did that house, which has been quite a while ago, it was well over 100 people involved in that. People were fixing food and all those kind of things. What other roles do volunteers play in this? I think everybody thinks they're builders.
Well,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say in the beginning when there was just mostly construction, it was just construction. And now with the expansion of the restores, we use and utilize people in there to help sort through the materials that are donated to us, price them, get them out on the floor. So we're picking up. From a restore perspective, with volunteers, we're picking up more hours there than we've ever had before.
Has that become a pretty important portion of your revenue, these stores? You got two, right?
Yes, we have two, absolutely. And the restores help cover our overhead. The wonderful thing about the restores, you know, when people donate to us, they don't necessarily, they didn't want to pay for Dan's salary, believe it or not.
Well, I can understand. No. Well, you're right. I mean, I get it. Donors.
Correct. Yeah. They don't want to donate to us, and they don't want to pay for overhead. So the restore allows us to pay for some of our overhead and then also fund homes, which is absolutely a wonderful thing. It's a great, great model.
Which then when people donate, they can say, you can say, that house is going to the wood that goes on here or to the concrete that's being poured. And people like that, right?
Right. Yeah. Go ahead.
They want to see their money go for something solid, not our heating bill or benefits or salary or whatever. They want to see that they're buying a window for this house or they're buying the doors or cabinets, whatever it might be. So that really gives them a feeling of engagement and know that they're helping somebody. You know, they bought this for this particular house and this particular family.
Are there people even around anymore? I mean, you would run into them. That don't know what Habitat is?
Every day.
Really?
Every day. There are people that still think that we give homes away, and we don't. We sell a home at a zero interest mortgage, and yet there are still people that have no idea that actually, you know, the partner family is paying a mortgage, and, you know, they're back on the tax rolls. I mean, right. A lot of these places, you know, a lot of these rehabs are back on the tax rolls. So a town and a city should be really excited with, you know, instead of a blighted home, now all of a sudden they're back on the tax rolls, they're paying insurance, and the mortgage is around $500 a month.
How much of it is misinformation versus don't know anything about habitat? Because that's kind of like a, somebody who knows about habitat but has a wrong definition of what you do. So what's that balance? I mean, I'm still trying to figure out, is there a lot of people just like, what's Habitat for Humanity?
I think a lot of people have heard of Habitat for Humanity, and they know that we build homes. And I think in the last 10 years since I've been engaged, that we've gotten the word out more so that people realize these people are paying taxes. They got skin in the game. And they're not getting something for nothing. They have to help earn it in whatever fashion that may be for the particular family. But I think the word's now getting out there that we're becoming more prevalent with the restores, more publicity, that more and more people are understanding that, hey, this is something that's a great thing because we're not giving them anything. You know, we're giving them an opportunity to live in a great home,
right,
a decent home, and for that they've got to go through the financial peace classes, the home ownership classes. They've got to learn how to change a furnace filter and where the water comes in and how you shut the gas off in the basement or crawl. So they're learning a lot of things that I think is really is what's changed and how Habitat has evolved and the families have evolved, and really are better educated to own a home and to make sure they own it forever.
And the Habitat partner families in Lake County, we require them 300 sweat equity hours. So they have to work on their home or in the restore or on somebody else's home, not your home, but another partner family home.
Darn, I was thinking maybe we could all just get some extra help. But.
Right. No, but they have to work, they have to put in 300 sweat equity hours. And most people who are buying a house don't put in 300 hours into their own home.
You know, in fact, a lot of people who've got money say, I don't want to do anything. I'd like the house to be perfect when I move in.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So the brand is strong. It's still that kind of misinformation that it seems to exist out there about what this is like. Let me ask this question, because you guys share a lot about this is Lake County. Habitat pretty much operates the same way all over the country, correct? I mean, the sweat equity is still required, the screening,
correct,
the education piece?
Yes.
All that's the same, no matter where?
Now, the sweat equity tends to be a little bit different. I think that I've heard that there are other affiliates that require 500 hours.
The number would be different.
Correct.
But they have to require sweat equity.
Correct.
Our affiliate is chartered through Habitat International, and the charter is the same for all affiliates in the United States. So they might have sweat equity, and they might be more or less than ours, but they have to have certain parameters that they have to meet to be a chartered Habitat affiliate.
So I might throw you off with this question, because we have a lot of viewers who are in the Chicagoland region. So is Habitat big over in the Chicago area? Are there many multiple affiliates, or how's that organized?
Yeah, in Chicagoland, they're huge, absolutely. I think they just did a wall build in downtown, I think at Millennium Park.
What's a wall build?
A wall build.
You build a wall, right?
You build all the walls for a house. So whether it's a church or a company, they actually pay. It's basically a fundraiser to build all the homes in a house, and we lay out all the material, all the wood, and kids from 2 years old all the way up to 80-year-old grandparents, they can come out and nail and create the walls, and we take them back.
And Dawn was instrumental in really getting this going, you know, since she's been with us, because it's a $5,000 commitment from the organization, whoever that might be. And with that, we'll come out to your parking lot and we'll drop the lumber there and we'll schedule everything. And in, you know, usually 4 hours, they've got all the interior and exterior walls built for the house. All they have to do is take them to the job site and put them up.
About 32 walls.
That reminded me, I think when we did this, that 50,000 first build, IUN was involved in that, and I think our fundraiser was we had a wall wood studs on the campus, and I think people, if you gave $5, you could drive a nail into it. It looked terrible at the end because all these nails were stuck in it, but we raised some money for it, so it was a good way to do it. So same kind of thing. It's amazing how horrible people were at driving a nail.
But the $5 helped.
But the $5 helped. How skilled do people have to be to help?
Well, for a wall raise, I mean, you don't have to be skilled at all. You can have your grandkids there, and you're just, you know, pounding nails, and you know this piece of wood has to go here because they're all pre-marked. It's almost like a puzzle, which is great. For a actual build, You don't necessarily need to be skilled at all, but you just need to be comfortable, I think, on a job site. You don't want to necessarily... we've had some people that, you know, show up in flip-flops, and you can't wear flip-flops on when, you know, you have, you know, compressors going and everything else. It's not safe. It's not safe. So, you know, people, you have to think about some of that as well.
So you get to educate them about how to take care of a home too, right?
Absolutely. Our construction manager does a great job in engaging people and finding out what their comfort level is and working on whether they're putting up the siding or they're putting in windows. You know, he'll walk them through what needs to happen. And if he's not available, we'll have team or crew leaders that will do the same thing.
So what is the, what do you hear is or understand about the great feeling, I guess, that people have if they come and help? What? Because you can't feel like you're really that productive hitting a nails a couple of times. And
I think the wonderful feeling comes when actually the partner family is moving in, to that house, and they come out for the day to help build. And you're building a wall, you're putting siding next to the person who's actually going to live there, and they're, you know, reinforcing the fact that, you know, they're thanking them. Thank you for your help. Thank you. I can't wait to move in. I can't wait to have my kids' first birthdays here and, you know, everything. So that's a great feeling when we do are able to have our partner families out on those builds.
I've seen that. That's real emotional. It can be very emotional. Since you've done this for 10 years, can you think back to maybe a family that, like, really touched you when, you know, without naming names, but just...
Well, it's. I've been through many house dedications, and that does tend to get emotional. We've gotten better with making sure the people who helped are invited and can actually attend, and we've grown those to sometimes there's 100 people at one of these. You know, we just never know, depending on the time of day. But it's a neat experience to watch these people sincerely. You know, when we hand the keys over, we'll leave them talk or let them say a few words, and they get choked up, and it's something that is a life changer for them. And the neatest part about this, Keith, is that there's been studies through Habitat Indiana that they work with Ball State that showed that people that have moved from rental apartments into homes and brought up their children have a higher skill level, higher level of progressing through education process. Wow. And so we have that data, and so we know it's the right thing to do. Not everybody knows that, but it's the neat thing is having the staff walk through our development person to our family services person to our volunteer coordinator. Everybody's helping them in some way, shape, or form get to the end goal. And it's neat to see the staff, you know, come around them as almost an outside family to get them through everything.
There are great statistics that show that there, you know, higher percentages in high school graduations. I mean, 100% higher graduation, a graduation for college. I mean, huge, huge statistics.
So this is a program making a big effect on people. It's not a handout, as they say, right? It's kind of a hand up. I want to talk a little bit about the past and present thing, or the future and past. Dan, in your time, what do you feel like was one of the greatest accomplishments the organization had while you were in a leadership role?
Wow, that's a tough one, Keith.
Maybe something you're proud of.
You know what? Just my first year in the position. Now, understand that I was the mayor prior, and I got into this role, and in the first 6 months, you know, I had to take over the reins, and part of the staff had gone, and we had a tornado come through and take down the front building on Ridge Road, and it was just overwhelming because when all this happened, people stopped paying their mortgages for whatever reason back then. And so we had to get onto a whole new accounting system that everybody could deal with and learn from. And it was the hardest job I think I've ever done in my life.
So you were at that point hoping that you could maybe just go back and be mayor again in Crown Point, right?
Well, when think about it.
And that's not an easy job either.
No. We're a construction company. We're a retail store. We're a project management firm. We're a social service agency, and we're a mortgage company because we hold the mortgages. So we're five things that need to have some skill level. And when I came into this, I'm not a construction person at all, but it was relying on the people and the board members to help get through this that had the expertise. And so we've progressed to the point now where I felt after 10 years leaving it to Dawn, we had a lot of processes and policies in place. We have a great board that we're able to reach out to. So I guess if it's that whole process of starting from here, because at one point we were building no homes, and now we're doing seven homes a year.
Wow.
That's great.
So hearing all that, Dawn, he must have left you with nothing to do, right? Because everything's perfect.
That's correct. So I just sit there.
So we all know in nonprofits that doesn't even exist.
That is true.
So what do you see into the future for this organization? You know, what do you hope to accomplish in the next 10 years?
Well, so the board has created a strategic plan, and the strategic plan in the next 5 years is to be able to be building up to 10 homes per year. We're currently at very comfortable with six, and they'd like to increase that to 10, and I think we can do that absolutely, where we will be building 10 homes per year and serving more families in Lake County.
So did you have that time in this transition where, you know, you could share a piece of wisdom with Dawn, like, here's one thing to make sure you never do or always do? Were you able to do that?
You know, it was an ongoing process, because when I had decided that I was going to retire, I wanted to make sure it was a smooth transition and not like what I had experienced. So we started with the board, and then, you know, got the board involved, knew that Dawn was a viable replacement, providing she was interested at that point in time. And so we looked and systematically went through the process, put a process down, and just started following step one, step two, step three, and it all fell into place. And the best thing about it was a three-month process. So we knew this was going to happen 3 months ahead, basically, and some things took a little bit longer, but it all worked out. It really did. And I'm, you know, we had a backfill Dawn spot, so Dawn was able to do that herself as opposed to having me fill it. So it was just a great, from my perspective, Dawn might feel differently, but I think it went pretty smoothly.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and it's rebroadcast on Sundays at 9:30 a.m. on Lakeshore PBS. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Tomorrow it's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We'll join Brandon Smith with the Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, as well as Joseph Pete with the Times, to tell about the stories that they worked on and put out online as well as in print, and in Brandon's case, on the air this week. And we hope you'll join us for Reporters Roundtable Thursday.